time for Yakety Science.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest corners of the research vessel, the lunar excursion module, and the deep submergence vehicle. We are the show that finds the fresco in your phycology, the gouache in your glaciology, the tempera in your toxicology, the pastel in your pathology. I am Brian Cross, Associate Professor of Biology at Tulsa Community College, and your humble host. First up, as always, the Watson to my bell, Matt Smith, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Tulsa Community College. Say hello to the nice people, Matt.
Hello, and I'm happy to be here, as always.
Excellent. Our guest on Yakety Science today is Dr. Valerie O'Brien, a retired member of the TCC biology faculty. She has done really interesting work on cliff swallows and their swallow bugs. This work was part of the long-running cliff swallow project that we heard about in our episode 2 interview with Dr. Charles Brown of TU. Welcome to the show, Valerie.
Thank you for having me. Nice to be here with my former colleagues and still friends, amazingly.
Right, yes. And we should note that Valerie was there at an earlier incarnation of this show. We were trying to launch this back in 2022, something like that, right? So I was actually there before she retired. And then that experience was so traumatic for her that she retired a year later.
I cannot.
So what have you been up to since your retirement, Valerie? You've been traveling quite a bit, I know.
I have gone to 4 countries since. Actually, it's not 4, it's 6. Not very good at math. Wanted to start with the first thing that I did was leave TCC, where I had taken on many, many responsibilities besides teaching, was completely overwhelmed, and it just about completely melted me down. So I retired and then immediately got on the board of the Tulsa Audubon Society.
Excellent.
As their treasurer.
Oh, okay, excellent.
For the uninformed, biologists aren't always the best at arithmetic. Like, I simply don't do my responsibilities, ask them to fire me repeatedly, and they continue to say, please, please stay. And I've actually enjoyed it, have learned a lot. I have traveled to, my first big trip was to Kyrgyzstan.
Wow.
By way of Istanbul, and then to Uzbekistan. One of the things that I found was that when I went to Kyrgyzstan, the other people on the tour would look out the window and say, oh my gosh, this is just beautiful, pristine wilderness. It's amazing. It's so gorgeous. It's so beautiful. And all I could see was anthropogenic degradation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm ruined. I'm just wrecked. That was really cemented to me when I went to North Queensland, which was a beautiful place and it was lovely. And the actual sort of landscape of the forest seemed okay. But when I went out to the Great Barrier Reef, which I had heard was in pretty bad shape, and scuba dived out there, people would get out and say, oh, we saw this and that. We saw a turtle. We saw a shark. And all I could see was it looked like a dirty asphalt parking lot.
Yeah.
The coral, the hard coral were bleached, and a lot of them were dead. And so as an ecologist, I have found maybe I better just stick to the city.
Yeah.
In my travel.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you were in a dead portion of the reef. I'm sure there are portions that are dead and portions that are living.
There are portions that are better than where I was. The bottom line is that I found in my trips, humans are amazing and wonderful and kind, and they do amazing things.
And destructive things.
And they've also ruined the world.
Yeah. There's the only things that we should be bleaching as humans is our ass.
All right. Excellent.
Yeah. Anal bleaching. It's a thing, Brian. Did you know about it?
Wisdom as you... No, I didn't, Matt. And I'm not going to have you teach me. So I understand you've been getting into trouble back here at home. You've been fighting with city officials about sick raccoons, which, of course, is a normal thing to do with your retirement.
That's a very typical thing for me. I've been writing letters to City Hall for a long time.
This is related to raccoons with distemper?
This is. So a year ago, there were a number of raccoons that were very visibly ill that were coming out in the daytime and ending up in people's yards here in Tulsa, particularly in the, like, Owen Park area outside of downtown and along the river. And when it was reported, it was determined these raccoons were part of an outbreak of distemper, canine distemper in raccoons. And the Tulsa Audubon Society was asked about it. You know, what can we do? What can we do about this canine distemper problem? People would call the city, and the city would say, you need to call the animal shelter. And then the animal shelter would say, that's ODWC's problem, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. The animal shelter would say, call a wildlife professional, removal professional. And the removal professional has to make a living, and so they charge $150. And well, I tried to get to the bottom of it. I'm a wildlife disease ecologist by training, mm-hmm. and understand something about disease spread.
So how prevalent is this problem? I must say that I've never run into a distempered raccoon. Is that the proper term, a distempered raccoon?
It feels like such like a Victorian era sort of like, oh yes, a canine distemper.
Yes,
oh,
it's just
dear.
Irritable.
Well, you're vaccinating your dogs for canine distemper. So right. I mean, it's a common
it's just
disorder.
It's just a funny term to use. Yeah,
it sounds like dyspepsia.
It sounds like they're of ill-tempered. Perhaps they're a bit, but well,
they've
the
got the consumption. Was it raccoon consumption?
Exactly. They would fall to the ground and drop their hanky.
Yeah.
And then no one would know what to do. But the issue is that after COVID, during COVID, people stopped bringing their dogs into the vet, and vaccination rates for dogs went way down. Oh, wow. So we have a lot of unvaccinated dogs in the city now. And we actually had one of the first cases of rabies in Tulsa in a long time.
Oh, really?
In Tulsa, yeah. So, and it bit somebody. And so we have a lot of unvaccinated dogs. The canine distemper is not... It cannot harm humans, and mm-hmm. it will not get cats. It just would be dogs. If the dog eats a dead raccoon, they could get distemper. Mm-hmm. But the other issue I looked at, and this is me. You guys know me. I'm this bleeding heart. I think that people should be respected in their communities, mm-hmm. and that part of the responsibility of the community is to care for the welfare of the humans in it.
Right.
And it's pretty distressing to a human who lives in a community to be told, well, just kill the raccoon with a shovel and bury it in your yard. Mm-hmm. That's the solution. Mm-hmm. And so that was what we ended up with. I know that the end of the story is it all ended back up at the Tulsa Animal Shelter. They asked for $50,000 to help control wildlife, mm-hmm. to be the wildlife, you know, pick up wildlife, injured right. wildlife. And they didn't get it.
Yeah.
So that was a giant circle that ended up with me chasing my right. tail.
Well, I can say as a resident of North Tulsa that there are dogs everywhere. And so they clearly don't even have the funds to deal with the dogs that are present.
They do not.
Yeah. So, all right, Valerie, thank you for that update on the distemper debacle here in Tulsa. And we will keep our eyes out for... diseased-looking raccoons, and we'll keep a shovel handy, I guess.
That's the solution given to us.
That's the solution.
Great.
I have many shovels, so
I'm
prepared. Before we pass on to the headlines, we should note that this is the final episode of Season 1. We began back in March, and we have somehow managed by hook or crook to make it through 14 episodes to arrive here at Episode 15. We will be going on hiatus over the holidays, and a wary and traumatized nation breathes a sigh of relief, yes. We expect to be back in February with new episodes. In the meantime, we may have some special releases, shorts, outtakes from previous episodes, little Christmas treats to keep you going until we return in February. So in the meantime, please do follow us on Spotify. We may be posting a few things there. And follow us on Facebook and Instagram. That's at Yakety Science. Well, what would you say to some headlines?
Oh, to headlines, I would say, hello, greetings, headlines.
How's it going?
How's it going? Please come in.
Valerie was much cooler than I was
yes.
in that moment.
Well, that's a given.
That's pretty much.
A given. That tracks.
Pretty much always. Next up, we have the headlines. In this segment of the show, we trawl through, or perhaps troll through, the science-y headlines that have struck our fancy since the last episode of Yakety Science. First up, cuckoo birds. You may know cuckoo birds from cuckoo clocks, but other birds out there in the environment know cuckoos as a threat. Cuckoos are brood parasites. What's a brood parasite, Valerie?
A rood parasite?
No, brood parasite.
Brood parasite.
You're a rood parasite.
That's
what's a
fact.
A brood parasite?
In an amoral way, I'll explain a brood parasite. Mm-hmm. They are birds that, in this particular case, birds that will lay their eggs in another species' nest. Then the other species, they raise the baby as their own.
Okay. So you're saying the brood parasites don't put any effort to raising their offspring.
Right.
They lay their eggs in the nest of another bird, a host bird, and they trick that host bird into raising their offspring.
Yes.
The yellow-billed cuckoo around here is a brood parasite. The brown-headed cowbird you probably see more frequently because they are often out kind of on the ground, foraging around on the ground, so you often see them. So this new bit of research that was published in Science Magazine just recently takes up the question of how do these birds, like the cuckoo, how do they parasitize so many different species, right? How do they manage to fool so many different species, given that all those species have, for instance, different egg coloration, right? How do they manage to produce different colors of eggs that match all those different species? You know, 100 years ago or more, the inventor of the Punnett square, some of you may know from genetics, Reginald Crundle Punnett. That's an excellent name, don't you think? Crundle.
Wow, Reggie Crundle.
Reggie Crundle Punnett. R.C. Pundit. I'm sure he had his friends call him R.C.
What friends? He's probably just sat in the basement sure making little crisscrosses.
He was the life of the party.
Bless
Come on,
his heart.
Right? He probably did Sudoku as well. So Reginald Punnett came up with this idea that's based upon the fact that female birds are heterogametic. What does heterogametic mean, Matt?
I'm going to go with they have different gametes.
Different gametes. Why do they have different gametes? Because they have two different sex chromosomes. So in humans, that is the males that are heterogametic because we have X and Y. Females are homogametic. They have two X's. But that situation is reversed in birds. Mm-hmm. And so in effect, there is this chromosome, the W chromosome, that is only passed along by the female, right? And so the idea here is that that W chromosome allows for the differentiation within the species without actually splitting into multiple species, the differentiation into different matrilines, different lineages of those W chromosomes that carry characteristics for egg mimicry. And so that is part of the solution that has been borne out, that hypothesis has been borne out for several species, and in part for the cuckoos. And what this current research was doing was just kind of filling in the gaps here and trying to get a better picture of like all of the different species that are parasitized by the cuckoo. Right, sort of what is the genetic basis underlying that? What's the picture? And they found that it's a bit more complicated, at least with the cuckoo. It's a bit more complicated than it has been for some other brood parasites, that it relates to the non-sex chromosomes, the autosomes as well, too, that there is an aspect of geographic separation, right? So this particular host species is more abundant over here, so all of the cuckoos are kind of specialized on it. But then there are other areas where the hosts are kind of mixed, and it's more of a sort of a matrilineal differentiation that happens within the same geographic region without there being any speciation. So I'm sure that was all perfectly obscure, but it's fascinating. It's just a fascinating question. So how do you get the kind of specificity that you need to exploit all these different hosts?
To me, what I started to think about was, we're talking about the European cowbird?
We're talking about the European cuckoo, yeah.
I mean the European cuckoo, sorry.
Eurasian cuckoo, I think.
The Eurasian cuckoo, and I started to think, well, how long have these cuckoos, how hyperlocal are they? How long have they been in the regions that they're parasitizing? Because I just looked up brown-headed cowbird eggs, and they're brown. They're just little brown eggs. And the birds, their eggs have not changed. They don't match eggs.
The
birds don't throw those eggs out. And I don't know if American birds are stupider than European birds.
I don't know.
Or what it says to me is that there was some really strong selective pressure in this particular bird at some point.
So it's hard to imagine this evolving, and we'll put a picture of this up online for people to look at. You can see the cuckoo eggs, and you can see the host eggs there. And so there's been selection. So Maybe the brown-headed cowbird is parasitizing species that do not police their nests for appropriately colored eggs. But there has to be, in these species, in these host species, it would seem that there have to be there has to be some sort of behavior that is creating a selective pressure for
which
that.
Which just says that there was time, there was pressure. There may have been a situation where these birds were had very few host species to mess with, and the host. I mean, in a parasite-host relationship, typically, the host has an adaptation to resist the parasite. Then the parasite jacks up their resist. You know what they do, and then.
They have a co-evolutionary cycle between the two.
They have that. And so there must have been, but there has to be a lot of pressure for that to happen. So with a brown-headed cowbird, likely because they're parasitizing just any and everybody's nest, the pressure wasn't there. The selective pressure, it just hasn't been there.
Matt, you wanted us to save this article for Easter.
Well, you know, eggs dying, you know, all these pretty colored eggs.
You thought that all those little kids celebrating Easter would like to hear about cuckoo birds murdering other birds, and you thought that would make their Easter.
I mean, I think it's the
joyous.
The joyous spirit of Easter, you know.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that
only if the birds are resurrected after they're shoved out of the nest.
Or I think it's fine for children to see those beautiful eggs and learn about the story and then recognize for the first time as they're coloring Easter eggs that there's dead baby chickens in there.
Okay. All right. Excellent.
I mean, I think it's time, and I don't believe that children should be taught there's a Santa Claus either.
All right. Well,
because that's why my children are on antidepressants now.
I lied to all of my children. So
I did not. And I've only got one on antidepressants.
All right, so I think that's enough for the cuckoo bird, more than enough. What's up next, Matt?
Well, do you want to talk about artificial blood?
Sure. This is like Halloween sort of blood, right?
You know, so, I mean, if you are a vampire, rejoice, because artificial blood is on the way in, strangely enough, a surprising grape flavor. Okay, it's not actually grape flavored, but it is purple colored. And you look at pictures of it, and I'm like, that is, like, plum. It's like thick purple color.
It's deoxygenated.
It's pretty wild. So, look, this is there's a few examples of HBOC. This is a hemoglobin based oxygen carrier. Look, we all need hemoglobin to ferry oxygen around in our cells. And should you be injured, lose a lot of blood, you'll do better if you can get some replacement. But donated blood has two hurdles: blood typing and shelf life. So, I got biologists here. Hey, biologist. What's the deal with blood typing? Why do we need to match blood types?
Because you could die.
You could die.
You get the wrong type.
Yeah. God, that's so informative. Thank
you. Your immune system responds to foreign blood proteins. But if you are type A, somebody gives you type B blood, your body recognizes the B protein as foreign, and your immune system attacks it. That causes your blood to clot, and then that's bad. You don't want
that's
your
generally
blood.
That's bad.
You don't want your blood to clot within your blood vessels.
Right. Indeed. Donated blood has a really short shelf life. It has to be refrigerated, and even then, it doesn't last too long in the refrigerator. So, you know, HBOCs are trying to solve this issue by taking the hemoglobin out of the red blood cell entirely and trying to use it on its own, or in a modified environment. They've done previous studies involving cell-free hemoglobin and also hemoglobin cross-linked with small polymer chains, and the cell-free hemoglobin is exactly what it sounds like. It's just hemoglobin injected into your bloodstream, not encased in a red blood cell. And that didn't work out very well. It's just too small. It gets in places it shouldn't. It didn't really work. So this project, this is by Hiromi Sakai of Nara Medical University in Japan, is using hemoglobin vesicles, which simulate erythrocyte structure and they're made from discarded blood. So the hemoglobin is extracted and encased in a lipid bilayer. Lipid bilayer. That's
the cell membrane.
That sounds like a cell wall, doesn't it?
Well, that's not the cell wall. It's a cell membrane.
Cell membrane. Okay. Wait, what's the difference between a cell wall and a cell membrane?
The cell membrane is the basic phospholipid bilayer that you find around all cells. And then many cells, not animal cells, but many cells have a cell wall that's around the outside of that, which is like cellulose or chitin or peptidoglycan, depending on the kind of organism you have.
I wonder if I've been misusing those terms interchangeably, thinking that they're the same thing.
You don't have any cell wall.
The slop happiness of the chemists.
Yep, that's what we do. That's what we do. Okay, so a cell membrane then. So these are basically synthetic red blood cells. They don't elicit an immune response due to mismatched blood typing because they don't have any of those. Mm-hmm. And they've been shown to be room temperature shelf stable for up to 2 years. Wow. So that seems to solve both things, but also, strangely enough, purple in color.
Well, Matt, what is the shelf life of, you know, regular donated blood? Like, I go and I give blood at Red Cross today. How long will that be good?
They're going to separate all the different components out of it, but the red blood cells that you care about, and in this study, only going to last about 40-something days. Okay. So this is a lot better than a month and a half.
All right, so this is 2 years.
It really is. So This first paper was published in 2022, actually. They had a study of 12 volunteers. I'm bringing it up now because this year they started clinical trials that are currently underway. They're hoping for a 2030 release into the actual public.
So they must have
fake blood.
So yeah. I'm excited. So that's exciting. Yeah. Blood.
That's interesting.
Yes. So all of us can just slack. I can get over my guilt because I can't give blood. Because I'm too small.
Same, right? Yeah.
Really? They won't let you. You're too. They go.
They
and
don't
you,
just it, have enough blood.
They say you're too short.
That's what happened like when I was a kid. So I guess I never really went back.
Your weight matters, and your hematocrit matters. Yeah. So if you're especially, I haven't checked lately, but I ain't gonna do it because I'm just small. Yeah. Yeah.
I went in. Like a year ago, and I haven't been in since, but I went in and I got a new phlebotomist, and it was quite a horrific experience of them digging around in my arm, and they didn't even get enough of the blood for it to work. They didn't get anywhere near a
Why did you need to go see a flea lobotomist?
A flea lobotomist?
That's
because,
really hard to do, to give a lobotomy to a flea.
And what are you going to do, though, with a mentally ill flea except lobotomize it?
No, just let it run for president,
or you
apparently.
Could squish it, I suppose.
Want to be humane. poor flea.
All right. Matt, you've got the next article as well, too. Magnets in space.
Magnets producing oxygen in space. This is reported in Nature this August. Electrolysis is still the best way to generate oxygen in space, or really most anywhere.
And we should note that space is notoriously oxygen poor.
It really is. I'm glad that even as a biologist you noticed that. If you want to make oxygen for you to breathe on the International Space Station, for instance, electrolysis is still the way to go. You're using electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. Now, under the force of gravity, the gases bubble out of the liquid, the water, and can be collected easily, right? They just bubble up. Because, you know, gravity is pulling the liquid down that squeezes the gases out of it. And there we go.
Hydrogen, got oxygen.
Yeah, the oxygen goes to one side of the cell, hydrogen on the other. Cool.
And that's good for rocket fuel as well, too, right?
Sure, we can use the hydrogen for that. It's fine stuff. The problem with doing this in microgravity, however, it's not that simple. The gases, they just cling to the polymer electrolyte membrane and have to be separated by centrifugation. They spin the cell really fast in order to squeeze the gas. They have to spin the entire device. The design is expensive in terms of mass, in terms of electricity, and in terms of replacement parts because there's so many moving parts of this thing. The current system consumes roughly a third of the energy used by the entire environmental control and life support system aboard the International Space Station. So the research group at the University of Bremen has designed a novel method for separating the oxygen from the water and the membrane using magnetism, and like not even like an expensive magnet. Literally, it's like the N52 neodymium magnet. You can buy them for less than a dollar on Amazon. And a little thing called the Lorentz force, which students might recognize as the right-hand rule for magnetic induction. It involves, hold out your hand with the thumb up. Hold out your right hand with the thumb up.
It's like magnetic field goes that way and the electric current goes that way.
That's how it goes. And if you curl your hand even, then you can see, okay, if the electric field is warping this way, the magnetic field goes that way. So it's that way, and also the straight version as well. So the straight version and the curled version for the right-hand rule. And so it's about the relationship between a magnetic field inducing an electric field or an electric field inducing a magnetic field. Mm-hmm. That's the Lorentz rule. So the combination then of this magnetic field on the already present electric field from the electrolytic cell can produce a vortex within the liquid, movement of the liquid within the cell. Normally, we do not notice this because under normal gravity, it is pathetically weak and easily just overcome by all the normal movement, you know, that happens in a liquid. But in microgravity, it can persist and cause the liquid to spin as if it is under in a centrifuge, which means without using any moving parts, they just slap a magnet in there and it spins on its own enough to separate the gases, and they improve the efficiency of the entire device.
Is the magnet stationary or is the magnet moving?
No, the magnet just sits there.
Sits there. It creates
a magnetic field, but the electric field is being made by the electrolytic cell between the anode and cathode already.
Uh-huh.
So it's like free.
Right.
It's free stuff. You just put the magnet there, and it works better in microgravity. It doesn't do anything different planet side, but in microgravity, it does work. So,
I mean, if you're going to do electrolysis, I don't know, where are we right now in culture with hair? Are we making our peace with potty hair, or are we still yanking it out with various?
Oh, we're yanking it out. Yeah,
we're still yanking it out.
Yeah.
So it could have dual use in space. If you're going in long-term space.
You lost me entirely. What are we talking about?
You don't know what electrolysis is?
In terms of hair removal? No, apparently not.
You zap the hair follicles, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Apparently they're going to think of this.
I don't know what electrolysis is on this end, but I do know what electrolysis is when I need a chin hair removed.
Got it. Okay. So electrolysis then, outside of the beauty care world, electrolysis is we're using electricity, passing electricity through a, you know, sample of water to split the H2O into H2 and O2. So the hydrogen will collect around one of the electrodes and the oxygen will collect around the other electrode. And we manage to split the water into two gases.
It's pretty awesome, and I'm glad to understand the difference and know that we're not going to be inadvertently plucking any chin hair.
Apparently not, no.
There's all this electrolysis going on the International Space
Station. They're very concerned about stray hairs.
They come back bald.
Very fastidious, these days, yeah. The fun thing that I was...
You don't want to deal with body hair in space. You can get snagged on things.
So the fun part about this was I was reading this and I was like, how do they do experiments in microgravity? Did they send experiments up to the International Space Station to do this?
I'm sure they did, yes.
And no, they did not. They did this on the planet. They did this. They simulated microgravity by going to, this is the University of Bremen. They used the Bremen Drop Tower, which is a 146-meter tall tower. And then they catapult up the experiment module. And towards the top, where it hangs and then starts to fall, it experiences weightlessness for up to 9 seconds. Yeah. 9 seconds of weightlessness.
Well, that's what they
time.
Do with the astronaut training. They do the what they call it, the vomit comet.
The vomit comet, yeah.
Where they go up and down,
Yeah,
and down,
it's
right?
The same. Yeah, where they have to. It's only at the top when they're doing the parabolic curve. It's the same sort of thing, but it's they use a catapult and free fall. So that's the end of my story. Magnets producing oxygen in space. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Matt. Very illuminating. Enlivened by your magnetic charm.
Oh, very nice. That's very sweet.
Your magnetic personality electrified me, Matt.
Wait.
All right, let's move on. Let's just keep going.
Your electric personality draws me in like a magnet.
Oh, my gosh. Get a room. Wait, you already got one.
It's a tiny room.
It is a tiny room.
It's pretty small.
Up next, we need to take care of last week's sound science puzzler. Here it is again for your consideration. You figure this one out? I know that Valerie did because you sent me the correct response to this. Would you like to tell everyone what that sound was?
I believe it was a lyrebird.
Yes, it was a lyrebird. And that's not a lyrebird like a bird that doesn't tell the truth. That is lyre, like L-Y-R-E, because it has these really funky tail feathers that kind of loop around and look like an old fancy lyre that paid in ancient Greek times.
Other than that, they're fairly... just brown birds.
Brown birds, but they have this fabulous mimicry ability. Just any sound in their environment. So, you know, any human-made sound, any natural sound, right? They can mimic it. So
that's kind of like, distressing then that a lot of the sounds it was mimicking was deforestation.
Right, yeah. So that's, yeah, they are playing back to us, to our own shame, playing back to us the sounds of destruction. But it's kind of like a mockingbird on steroids. So yeah. Really cool.
And the females find this apparently very sexy.
Yes.
Super sexy.
All right, up later in the show, we'll have a new sound science puzzler for you.
Totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's.
Next up, we have Matt's Chemical Minute, a segment lasting 5 to 7 indeterminate units of time. Matt is going to tell us about an element, a compound, or some other chemical entity, it'll be an element, that we should care about. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and then potentially argue with Matt about his rating. Today, Matt takes up phosphorus, the most phosphorific of all the elements, atomic number 15. Matt, take it away.
Thank you. So, yeah, phosphorus occupies an historic moment in our quest through the elements. It is actually the first element to be isolated since the days of antiquity. So, you know, ancient people knew about, you know, certain
sodium
elements. Yeah, sodium, iron, platinum,
gold.
Even gold.
They loved gold.
Yes, but this was the first one to be identified since then. The story's a little bit weird. This is 1669. Hennig Brand. This is in the days of alchemy. So actually, the dude was actually trying to make the philosopher's stone by boiling lots of urine, because apparently that's also what alchemists do. They love boiling urine. There's something special about urine that they think is going to, like, solve all their problems.
So many uses for urine. I mean, in the ancient world, there's urine for everything, right? You're using it for cleaning your clothes, honestly. It was used for laundry, right?
That was the etymology of my name. My maiden name was Walker, and it was Welsh, and it means a person who trods on cloth.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't.
On urine-soaked cloth?
That's correct.
Excellent.
They used urine as a mordant. People would stop at the village.
It's a fixative, right?
And pee into the tank, and then my ancestors would walk on it in their bare feet. And so if you had wondered whether I was descended from royalty.
Yeah, there you go.
Now you know.
Now you know. It's not. It's not true.
Does anybody else feel it's just scandalous how we just waste our urine these days? I mean, we could be using it for all of
it
these.
It could go towards
so
scientific discoveries. It's
science.
True.
You guys are not on the side of the internet. That will tell you how many millions of people are daily drinking their own urine and would probably like to purchase yours.
Oh, dear.
Oh, my Lord.
Well, anyways, can we go back to talking about alchemy?
We are talking about alchemy.
So well, he boiled a bunch of urine, like I think it was 1,600 gallons of urine. That he boiled down to have enough concentration of whatever he was looking for, which turns out was phosphate salts, which he unknowingly separated and heated with carbon-containing compounds that are also in urine. And all of this, with extreme heat in his furnace, converted the phosphate groups into phosphorus, just elemental phosphorus, and which I'm sure was very interesting to him because he produced this substance that, when reacts with air, to glow visibly. So, you know, white phosphorus is what he made, and that reacts with air. And so he was very excited about this. So he calls this phosphorus, as in, you know, the light bringer, as in Venus, the morning star, which is kind of weird because phosphorus is not phosphorescent. Mm-hmm. It's chemiluminescence. Fluorite is fluorescent. Mm-hmm. That's where that thing comes from. But there's no phosphorus-containing compound that is known to be phosphorescent. Isn't that just... It's a lie. It's such a lie.
Only a fool would think so.
Right, exactly.
Hello, my name's Valerie O'Brien, and I'm a fool.
I mean, I would have thought it too, you know, that phosphorescence
never
has something
thought
to do
about
with
it.
I knew I was surrounded by fools.
It just has to do with light being brought in.
So what is the difference between phosphorescence and...
And fluorescence?
Yeah.
I'm ready to talk about this. You know, normally when a photon of light is absorbed, an electron is excited to a higher energy level, and then it immediately returns, and the light is re-emitted in a random direction. Fluorescence is when the energy of the absorbed photon is emitted, not as much as absorbed, like you absorb X amount and you emit X amount. Well, no, this in fluorescence, it's emitted instead as 2 or more photons of lesser energy. So it absorbs a high energy photon, such as a UV, Then fluorescent, like fluorite, fluoresces that UV down into two different or multiple, you know, photons. One of them is in the visible range, at least. And so you get that nice glow under a black light. Phosphorescence,
and we're the long-winded ones.
That's right. Hey, now. Phosphorescence, then, is like fluorescence, but that electron gets stuck in a defect and gets held, like, in place and doesn't actually pop down until seconds, minutes, or even hours later.
Which one is that?
Phosphorescence. That's why it's a time delay there. As if you've seen glow-in-the-dark toys, you know, you can put them in the sunlight and they charge up. Uh-huh. And then when you take them out of the light, it takes a long time sometimes for some of those electrons to pop down
into
place.
Settle back down, yeah.
So there are multiple types of elemental phosphorus. It has many allotropes. The most famous of one is white phosphorus, which is P4. White phosphorus is what you think of when you think of phosphorus when it, you know, self-ignites. So stuff like, you know, phosphorus, it was used in like rockets. Also famously used in the first matchsticks. Matches would use white phosphorus in the tip as the lighting mechanism. You know, when you scratch off the wax that protects it from the air, then the phosphorus would light on its own. Cool, great. Unfortunately, white phosphorus is hella toxic and can lead to a fun little thing called phossy jaw.
Phossy jaw
is phosphorus necrosis of the jaw. And this happens in match factories. There was a lot of white phosphorus vapors floating around, and as a long-term effect of that, you can get phossy jaw. The white phosphorus converts into, through normal bodily process, when it enters the body, it can be turned into amino bisphosphonates in the body, which, oddly enough, amino bisphosphonates, they're used to treat osteoporosis. And yet these same bisphosphonates, when they're in your jaw, can lead to phossy jaw.
So they have opposite effects?
They have absolutely opposite effects on different parts of the body.
I wonder what the physiological basis for that is. That's interesting.
Valerie, weren't you saying earlier about you're not supposed to take bisphosphonates when you've had any dental work done?
They always ask if you've had dental work, and it must have something to do with having abscesses and ways that drug can get into the tooth mouth area. And,
oh, how about this? Phosphorus is a List 1 precursor chemical, as listed by the Drug Enforcement Administration, because it can make
meth.
Meth. Mm-hmm. Yes, it can. It can be used in the production of meth. Elemental phosphorus can react with iodine to form hydroiodic acid, which can reduce the pseudoephedrine to methamphetamine. So it is a controlled substance. Don't go buying elemental phosphorus out there.
So what your purpose of your podcast, understanding as a first time guest, a long time listener, is to tell people how to make drugs.
Yes,
with chemicals.
Absolutely.
Well, we're telling people how to make drugs so that they can avoid that.
That's right.
So we're telling you, so don't accidentally do this.
Yeah, don't do this.
Don't accidentally do this because you might end up accidentally making
Well, besides,
drugs.
While you're making meth, you might get phossy jaw.
It's a public service.
And that would be bad.
Phossy jaw.
Yeah, you might get phossy jaw. They eventually stopped using phosphorus, didn't
there they? There had to be one bad thing about meth. I mean,
well, Walter White wasn't. I mean, Walter White knew that. That's why he wore a gas mask.
That is that's what I have to say about phosphorus. How do you biology people feel about phosphorus?
Generally phosphate positive or phosphorus positive. ATP, adenosine triphosphate, major energy carrier in the body. Phosphate is part of the DNA molecule as well, too.
The phospholipid bilayer?
Bilayer. You wouldn't have cell membranes without phosphorus. I mean, phosphorus is...
I'm a big fan.
It's not the largest portion of living systems, but it is a key portion of the genetic molecule, the membrane, the energy carrier. So it's a key element.
Sounds
key
like you
element.
Like it.
It's negativity right. makes us positive.
Yes.
That's right. That's cute. That's very cute.
It's hydrophilic.
What's a little phossy jaw? I mean, among friends.
Among friends. So many people are on these bisphosphate things for osteoporosis.
Phossy jaw is making a comeback.
And instead, the doctors use this really awful term, jaw necrosis. Mm-hmm. Which
True.
Is an icky word, and we should replace it with phossy jaw.
Who wouldn't want to have phossy jaw?
And you go in, and you're like, Doc, my this is really hurting. And, oh, and they look at you, and they're like, it's okay.
You, get a you just got the phossy jaw.
Mandibular necrosis. Phossy jaw.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We need a rating.
Yeah, you need a rating?
I need a rating.
You start us off.
All right. I don't know. Extremely biohazardous as an element. And honestly, the fact that its name says it glows in the dark, but it doesn't glow in the dark, mm-hmm. kind of takes it down a few points. But even though it's overall pretty neat, I'm really just going to give it 3 stars.
3 stars. Oh, that's an injustice. Right. You wouldn't exist without phosphorus, my friend. Yeah, you have to give it a rating kind of up there with carbon. So, and Fossigel, we've already established, is a fun thing to have. So I'm going to say 5 stars. I don't know what else I can say.
Valerie?
I agree with Brian entirely. And I would add that I don't care what your name is. I care more about what you do for me.
Yeah.
It's very deep.
Yeah.
It's very deep. So, number?
5 out of 5.
5 out of 5.
All right. So that is 4 2/3 of a star.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty high.
Look at you doing that math.
Look at that. That's
dividing 13
and
by
3. And you don't even know if I did it right.
I do know. <don't> you? 12 divided by 3 is going to be 4. And then the extra 1, you divide by 3, you get a third. So you
It'd be 4 1/3 then. I said 4 2/3.
Did you say 4 2/3?
I did. I thought you said four.
It's 4 1/3.
It's 4 1/3. You're right.
Corrected by a biologist.
That's embarrassing. You'll cut that out, right?
All right. We're gonna cut your bow tie off because you don't deserve it anymore, my friend.
Please forgive me.
All right. Excellent. So, with season 2, we're gonna start off strong with the flatulence element that is sulfur. So. Atomic number 16.
Good way to ring in the new year.
That's right. It's a stinky start to the new year.
I think it was very fitting for us.
Excellent. Thanks, Matt. And that brings us to Yakety Science Ruins the Movies. In this segment, we will take on a Hollywood blockbuster and pedantically explain how they got the science so incredibly wrong. Yes, we are those know-it-all people that you never want to take to the movies. We just can't enjoy ourselves. We want to share that lack of joy with you. To get us started today, listen to the following. This clip is, of course, from the latest film adaptation of Frank Herbert's classic Dune. In this scene, Paul Atreides, heir to Duke Leo Atreides, the Kwisatz Haderach of the Bene Gesserit, the Muad'Dib of the Fremen. This is the scene where Paul first rides one of the massive sandworms that make the planet Arrakis such a charming vacation destination for the rich and powerful. Paul's facility with worm riding is one of the signs that he is oh so very special indeed. He is able to ride the worms like a native-born Fremen, and there is much celebrating balloons and jubilation. It is the worms we want to focus on here, though. These worms are one of a number of several sci-fi creatures whose basic biology, metabolism, and life cycle is a veritable Gordian knot of weird transformations, exotic chemistry, and sudden niche shifts. So the adult worms here can grow up to 400 meters in length and 40 meters in diameter, and they tunnel through the sand and attack anything making the wrong sort of vibrations.
All right, so but where do they come from? Because these are huge, huge, monstrous, you know, worms. But they don't start out that way, do they? You have the previous thing, right? The larval stage, the sand plankton, the sand trout.
That's right, yeah. So the sand plankton are the smallest form. They are a species of microbe that lives in the sand and feeds off the spice, the melange, that allows for interstellar travel entirely plausibly.
Space cocaine.
Yes,
yeah.
Space cocaine.
Indeed. And then there's the sand trout, which are that will seek out and sequester water because water is, you know, toxic to sandworms, to the full-grown sandworms.
To the full yes. That's one of the odd parts about this.
They go from the sandworms, which seek out the water and want it, to becoming the adult worms, which it's toxic to them.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre. So the sand trout seek out the water in the sand, and when they encounter the water, they sequester it, and they mix it with their own excretions.
Mm-hmm.
And then explode.
They explode, yeah.
They explode, and that creates the spice. That's the pre-spice mass, and they blow up. I guess they like it. I don't know. Why do they do this?
They do blow themselves up. No reports on whether they actually like it. I suppose it'd be fun, right? Exploding up to the surface there and landing. There's some sort of byproduct that they produce. You know, it's like they're generating methane gas or something that then is combustible, and then they explode, and then they get thrown up to the surface, and they land on the surface with all the pre-spice. Most of them die, and the pre-spice is then going to get baked on the surface into the actual spice.
Indeed. Yeah. Which the worms never really eat. They're not here for the spice. They just happen to make it during this part of their life stage.
Right, but then the sand plankton feed upon it somehow.
A little bit, yeah.
But the sand plankton also must be some kind of autotroph as well, too, because, I mean, it's really strange because you've got then the survivors of the explosions start cannibalizing each other, and the biggest of them then become the giant sandworms that are 400 meters long. And then the giant worm is feeding off of sand and sand plankton. So it's a...
That's a circular food chain, isn't it?
You can't really...
It is. It starts off with the sand plankton, then becomes the sand
trout,
then becomes the sand worm, which then eats the sand plankton.
This is the kind of Ouroboros, the sand worm eating its own tail. But you need some sort of energy input. And there are, I mean, I've read in different places these references to like their autotrophs, and that's the input of energy. I don't know.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I don't know what the sandworms are eating. Also, apparently, I saw something that they are responsible for the oxygen content of Arrakis because there's no plant life, very little plant life, and so they're the ones producing the oxygen.
I guess the sand plankton is not doing it. That would be the obvious place to go, would be to say that the sand plankton were doing it.
Well, they do call the sand plankton the half-animal, half-plant stage of life.
And that's the reference I was referring to where there's some suggestion that they are autotrophic, and they would have to be. There would have to be some sort of input of energy. But what is the process that they're using? Because they're not living primarily at the surface. So how are they not using sunlight directly? Are they doing some sort of chemosynthesis? If so, where are they getting the electrons? What are they stripping it from? Are they stripping it from silicon dioxide, from the sand? I mean, that doesn't seem chemically favorable, you know. And if they're not producing the oxygen, then the worm is producing the oxygen.
Ripping it out of the sand itself? Is it just leaving a wake of silicon in its wake?
Splitting it, yeah. So is any of this producing enough energy that a giant worm could plow itself through the sand?
I have a question.
Yes.
About the worm?
Yes.
Is it an invertebrate or a vertebrate?
I don't know that has been worked out. I think it has a pretty tough outer covering. So
it's described that the entire internal structure of the worm is just one big tube blast furnace. Factory.
I'm just vaulting to physics. Mm-hmm. Is there gravity?
Yeah.
Yes.
So
gravity plus a lack of an endoskeleton and being 40 meters across or 150 meters long equals a pile of goo.
Yeah. So how does it support itself?
Invertebrates, no, unless it's in water.
Yeah. I was just focusing on energy and like how does energy get inputted into this system? That's a really key part of it.
So like how does it even move forward? Like does it do the worm thing where like it pushes part of it forward then it brings it up, you know, does that kind of segmented
it
worm
seems
sort
to
of
just
move?
Flow.
It seems to be like jet propelled.
Yeah.
Maybe its butthole is a jet engine.
Could be. And I mean I think you've seen I know that there's these blogs are, I don't know if it actually comes from Hank Herbert or not, but where they talk about like the static electricity created by pushing through the sand then creates energy that heats up the furnace and then...
But he's going to spend more energy moving than he's going to glean from the static electricity or whatever. I think this is just breaking all the laws of thermodynamics I can think of.
I think it's really, really tenuous here.
I don't... Are humans walking on the sand?
They are walking, but they have to walk in a very particular pattern so they don't attract the worm. And this is the other thing. Why is the worm eating all of this stuff? Why is it eating these spice harvesters and different things? And whenever a human being walks in the wrong way, why does it? Because if it's feeding off of sand and sand plankton, then why is it feeding off this stuff? And why did it evolve those giant teeth? You know,
they are described as being fiercely territorial, and they will attack and eat each other. Yeah. So maybe the teeth is a...
Evolved to eat each other.
Also, there's a big gap between I eat plankton, I also eat my brothers. That's a big size difference in things that you are eating.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there are things that we know of that do that.
Right. Like, it's basically a filter feeder.
It's like a big baleen whale of the sand or something, and they have specialized baleen, whale bone, that has little threads to it that filter out the small food particles. So if you're wanting to feed on something like sand plankton, you'd have to have some way for separating the little
food
particles out.
Then they seem to just be gobbling up the sand as they pass.
And so they're having to put all this energy into melting the sand, and there must be glass coming out the hind end, so they must be like blowing,
because it is described as just blast furnace.
They must be blowing glass, little baubles and Christmas ornaments and things are coming out of the hind end. So it just seems like they've glossed over the most important point, which is like, where does the energy come from? What is the input of energy? I mean, it's fun to come up with all these different ways of different things eating each other and circular food chains and so on. But if you don't understand that there has to be an input of energy, because each transformation is going to involve energy loss, you can't just have this perpetual motion circular food chain. I mean, you're missing something key. And it seems like an afterthought, this whole half plant, half animal. And they never specify what it is and how they're actually, what is the source that they're using for the chemosynthesis, if that indeed is what's going on here. All right, I think we've done this to death.
We done doing it.
And I fully expect lots of people to write it and say, no, what you're not understanding is X, Y, and Z, and that may be true. This could be called Yakety Science is Confused by the Movies.
That's always fun.
Instead of Yakety Science Ruins the Movies, but that's it. That's all I got.
Love it.
Eirenikos prosphilos eleluth.
Up next, we have our new Sound Science Puzzler. In this segment, I will challenge you to identify a science-related sound. It could be the sounds made by an animal, physical phenomenon, or it could be something that is associated with science in some other way. Here is your new Sound Science Puzzler. Now, I will give you a hint to this one. It does connect very strongly to another thing that we discussed, another segment of this show. This is not an animal sound. This is a physical phenomenon. This is created by non-living matter that is interacting and creating the sound that you're hearing. And it is connected to something that we talked about earlier in the show. So you might think about the other segments of the show. Okay. You guys have any ideas about this one?
It just sounds ominous.
Ominous, yes. It sounds like somebody's about to say, in a world.
I thought it might be the effort noises of the cuckoo nestling, pushing the other babies to their doom.
Could be. All right. If you think you know the answer, send it to yakketyscience@gmail.com. Make sure to include your name, your phone number, your social security number, date of birth, and your mother's maiden name. All of that is much appreciated. We will reveal the answer in the next edition of Yakety Science. Well, that's it for this final episode of the first season of Yakety Science. Thank you for joining us, Valerie. It's been great to have you.
I've loved being here. Thank you.
Excellent. And Matt, thank you as always.
I'm surprised they let us keep doing this. So yes. I'm just stoked.
It's a constant revelation every new episode. As always, we leave you with a wise, wise quote from a scientist of note. This episode's quote comes from Stephen Hawking. Look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make sense of what you see and wonder what makes the universe exist. Be curious. With those wise, wise words, we leave you, dear listeners, until the next episode of Yakety Science. Thanks for joining us.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yakketyscience@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. right. What do you say to some headlines?
I'm ready for headlines. Sorry.